Blog Talk Radio.
Become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite, Facebook at facebook.com/moviegeeksunited, YouTube at youtube.com/moviegeeksunited, or bookmark our website at moviegeeksunited.net. And you can also access our entire library of programs, including more than 600 filmmaker interviews, right here on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited. Tonight, actor Thomas Jane will join us to talk about a very special upcoming event taking place in Tampa, Florida at the International Gasparilla Film Festival. That'll be a little bit later, but first, we'll delve into some movie news with the Movie Geeks. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up?
The big news this past week, around 1968, when Stanley Kubrick released 2001, he had finished a draft of an epic script about the life of Napoleon. This was a dream project that he chased for many years, but it never came to fruition. And actually, to give you a sense of what his hopes were for the project, he wrote to an executive at MGM about his plans for Napoleon. And this is what he had to say. "I propose we make a deal to film Napoleon based on the following premises. I will do a new screenplay. Naturally, in the 2 years since the first one was written, I have had some new ideas," because MGM rejected the first screenplay he completed in 68. He said, "It's impossible to tell you what I'm going to do, except to say that I expect to make the best movie ever made."
Dude, that's Kubrick, but that's brilliant.
Isn't that great?
Oh, that is.
So the big news this week is Napoleon never happened, and he gave certain excuses, the main one of which there had been a Rod Steiger, I think, Napoleon film that tanked, and that was a similar excuse to what he said about his Holocaust movie, with Schindler's List kind of stealing his thunder. I don't know that I completely buy that excuse.
I don't either, because
yeah.
Wartime Lies, the Louis Begley novel, is very different from Schindler's List. So
but
I don't.
He had that cast. I mean,
Uma.
The cast was ready
Uma
to go.
Was going to be in that at the time.
Yeah. But anyway, that was his excuse. But the big news this past week is that Spielberg, as he did with AI, with the cooperation of the Kubrick estate, has revived Kubrick's script for Napoleon, and he's working to develop it as a TV miniseries. First of all, first impressions from you guys, good idea or bad idea?
Good idea. I mean, I don't have a problem with it. I mean, you know, there's only been really one truly great Napoleon movie, and that's, you know, from, well, you know, close to 100 years ago. I mean, you know, that's been, you know, the Abel Gance film. You know, that's the only one that's really good. So, I mean, we're due for another one. So let's do this one.
I think it's a good idea. There's been some talk that it's kind of heresy to actually propose it as a miniseries, but Kubrick himself proposed it as a miniseries. You know, he said it would work better as a 20-hour adaptation for television. But at the time, that that model didn't exist, you know. The miniseries didn't really exist at the time, so and he didn't feel that there would be enough money for it or support for it. So, but now there obviously is, and I mean, what's great about it is, you know, we have his script, so there is a Stanley Kubrick script. I mean, it is going to be a script by Stanley Kubrick. So that's exciting in and of itself right there. Anybody saying, oh, well, I don't know, Spielberg should just leave it alone. No, produce it. He's exactly the right guy to do it.
I do think that Kubrick would put it on TV now. I mean, if you were still alive, I think that he, and more than likely, he would give it to HBO. And I do think Spielberg has a relationship with HBO, obviously, from all the stuff he produces with Tom Hanks, the World War II stuff. I do think that if it goes anywhere, it'll go to HBO. Secondly, the reason why Kubrick, I would think, would have gone with HBO for it is because Kubrick had a career-long collaboration with Warner Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So Time Warner and HBO, I mean, they're... So I think it would happen the same way if Kubrick were alive and he were to pursue a Napoleon project. The worry is about... Like you said, Dean, the worry is not so much the form it takes, but Spielberg behind a Kubrick project, because those people that weren't convinced by the tone of AI, they don't like the idea of Spielberg's sentimentality barging in on Kubrick's particular tone.
Well, I mean, the thing to allay those fears is the fact that I think, you know, they're going to be they're going to cleave extremely closely to the screenplay, because the screenplay exists. I mean, they don't have to, I doubt they have to go in and rewrite it. They might have to, you know, cut some things or whatever, but
right.
I truly believe that they're going to stay with the script. And so that's the difference. I mean, the script for AI, I mean, wasn't fleshed out, you know, in Kubrick's lifetime. You know, not dialogue-wise and so forth, and structure, maybe slightly structure-wise, but that's the difference. The difference there is, you know, is obvious.
Right.
I don't think there's going to be. First of all, I don't think you're going to see Spielberg. You know, if it's going to be 20 hours or however long it's going to be, 10 hours or 12 or whatever. Spielberg might direct one or two episodes, but it's not going to be directed by the same person, I don't think.
Right.
You know,
yeah, I don't think you bring in a lot of different directors. You might actually even bring in a lot of the great HBO directors that they have do, like, Boardwalk Empire and Game of Thrones, maybe.
Well, I think the big-profile directors actually would probably be a project that they're interested in, because instead of being afraid of following in Kubrick's footsteps, I think if they handled it like, this is my way to give back to the master, to kind of pay tribute to what he's done for me. And I could think of a couple of candidates
that would probably
jump at it. The one person that's really interesting that they said would be a great choice to adapt a Kubrick script. And by the way, there are a couple of Kubrick scripts out there that they're developing that he never did. Like Lunatic at Large is one of them. That Scarlett Johansson's cast in it, a couple other people, I think. But the director that they bring up a lot in terms of tone is Michael Haneke.
That's interesting.
I don't think that... something tells me that this is not something that he would be interested in doing. You know, I mean, maybe tone-wise. I mean, I think, you know... he's just more interested in doing smaller movies, like chamber pieces, sort of.
Right.
But I think it'd be interesting, you know, my number one pick for someone who should throw in on this project, well, I have two, really, and they're the two most Kubrickian filmmakers that are out there. One of them is now doing television, largely, and we've interviewed him on the show, and that's Keith Gordon.
Right.
Because if you go and look at all of his early works, The Chocolate War and Mother Night and Midnight Clear and so forth, they all you know, very much smack of a Kubrickian feel. And another director is Mark Romanek, He did 1 hour photo and also
Never Let Me Go.
Never Let Me Go. And I think he would be a tremendous, if they're trying not to just go for, because you know they're not going to get, just a list of, Ridley Scott doing an episode and all A-listers doing it. They're gonna have to get a little creative. It's just inevitable. And
right.
So I think they should go to those guys because they definitely,
well,
definitely
yeah, and
feels
I think
like.
What about
yeah.
Paul Thomas Anderson, though?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, but again, he's just somebody that I think is frying other fish. But I mean, maybe he he's definitely no stranger to big movies. So.
Right. I mean, but he's obviously very much. I mean, even more so than the two that you mentioned. I mean, he may be the most of all Kubrick's children.
Well, here's the Hollywood Reporter's suggestions. They suggest David Fincher.
I was thinking
They suggest P.T. Anderson, Martin Scorsese, Catherine Bigelow, which I don't necessarily see, Ridley Scott, Christopher Nolan, and here's a great suggestion, a left-of-center suggestion of Peter Weir.
That's a
really good one because he's definitely in his wheelhouse with just his past works. I can imagine
a lot of big name directors throwing their hat into the ring and doing episodes of the miniseries.
You can?
Oh yeah, I mean
I really can.
This is a big enormous deal. I mean. I think everyone might, if this thing is really going to get going, is going to want in on this.
As long as none of them go to J.J. Abrams, I'm fine with it. J.J. Abrams has taken enough.
J.J. Abrams
yeah.
is just, I was thinking about this day, just looking at that Star Trek trailer that's on. I mean, he's just going to be, I think his fate is sealed forever.
Yeah.
I mean, let's just say he's now associated with two of the biggest science fiction properties of all time. No one's calling him for anything else. Okay, that ain't.
I don't. I don't think so too. Yeah, you're right. But I can see Fincher doing it. But here's another point. A lot of the stuff that he didn't use for Napoleon, he put in Barry Lyndon. A lot of people are arguing he didn't need to make his Napoleon. He made Barry Lyndon.
It's not the same story. I mean,
tone-wise, but visually it may be.
Yeah, I mean, but they don't even take place in the same country.
Right.
In terms of
visually, a lot of his visual landscape for Napoleon, he put right into Barry Lyndon
mm-hmm.
instead because he wanted to shoot by candlelight. He wanted to do that for Napoleon.
Oh,
that's
true.
Yeah.
The candlelight thing, for sure.
Gave mm-hmm. candle makers enough money to get their kids through college, that movie.
what's great about it, too, is there's already, of course, there was that book that came out, I guess, last year, which I still need to get, the Napoleon, the greatest movie never filmed. But it's put out by Passion, and it has, of course, a lot of his studies for locations and set dressings and costumes and so forth. So really, almost like this movie is just—it's just on the verge of already being made. Really,
yeah, yeah.
it's really just a matter of getting boots on the ground and actually doing it. I mean, it's like. It's sort of like a paint. It's almost like I liken it to like a paint by numbers set or something
right.
like that. I mean, that's simplifying
yeah.
it way too much. I know there's
but,
going to be a
but
lot
so,
of work.
But so much
it,
of his
but.
Movies were made in the making of them, which means that how he let scenes evolve as he shot them.
Right.
I mean, it really was kind of like the movie being made on the day.
Mm-hmm.
Because he wasn't the kind of guy that shot what was on the page. And we got it, and let's move
right.
on. I mean, he was kind of the exact opposite. I'm bad in a lot of ways.
Yes.
So director really makes a difference. And the other thing is that in terms of budget, I mean, this thing would have been wildly expensive back in the day when he first wanted to do it. I'm sure you could cut a lot of budget now with CGI and all that kind of stuff. But
right.
Still, an incredibly ambitious project, and you got to find somebody with the dough. And I'm sure they're going to be haggling over budget when this comes to the dealing table, you know.
And that's that is an interesting thing you bring up, because, you know, with Kubrick, there wasn't that haggling. I mean, everything goes. I mean,
because he was very respectful with money.
Yeah.
I mean, minimal crew. He was actually, why did they give him complete autonomy beyond just the prestige of carrying a Kubrick film? He was a smart filmmaker. Even
yeah.
if he took a year to shoot a film, he only shot with such a minimum crew, and his actors already cut their fees so
right.
low that they weren't losing money.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it would be interesting to see him in today's environment that's just like runaway spending.
I think he'd still be working in the same exact way that he always
worked. Oh, yeah.
Worked.
I, you know, he's not the kind of guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he adapted, obviously, to technology and that sort of thing, but he was not the kind of guy that said, oh, well, we're doing this now. No, he's like, no, we'll do it. I do things my way.
Got it.
That's how we're going to do them for as long as I walk this earth.
And how much would he embrace the digital technology and the special effects technology? I mean, I think he would have for something like AI because it was unavoidable. But in terms
right.
of doing Napoleon, would he not want to do crowd scenes, battle scenes with CGI?
My guess is that he would say no to that.
I don't know. That's a really good question. I don't think he'd have the studio spend $300 million on a prequel to The Wizard of Oz, though. But I'm not just saying that, I just look at the prices of the two movies that have come out in the last 2 weeks, Jack and Oz. The budgets are just if I had that kind of money, the last thing I'd do is make a movie, to be quite honest with you. if I had that kind, but I don't think he would. I think he would use it for what he needed to use it for. He wouldn't say, oh, we can do this with it. No, he'd be like, I need to use it for this scene or this part, but I don't think he would let it dictate how he made movies.
It's true. That's absolutely true.
It's going to be a fascinating project to follow.
It will. I'm so glad that it's happening. I've wished for it to happen for years and years and years. I just said, why don't they make it? Somebody should make it.
And the whole thing about Spielberg being sentimental, the whole thing about the sentimental Steven Spielberg, it's true. I mean, he is. Even in something as dark as War of the Worlds, which that movie's pretty dark, he still tacks on that happy ending, which a lot of people found completely false. But
how did that street remain intact? That's why I love the movie. But you just get to that part, and you're like, wait a minute, how did these guys get out of here unscathed? What the hell?
It's true.
But then you look at something like Munich. I mean, the nude woman that they assassinate. I mean, they shoot her in the head, and she's there, and her whole female genitalia is hanging out. And I mean, he's gone to some dark places. I mean,
that's one of the most tragic scenes in all of his movies.
Three truly grown up movies. I mean, if you want to call it Schindler's List, Private Ryan. And obviously Munich are his darkest. When he's dealing with issues of the war or with the results of the war, and especially with Jewish issues, he's very dark because I don't see how else you can be with the issues of the Holocaust and the Israeli-Palestinian thing. I don't see how you can't be sentimental. There's no way to be really sentimental. I really don't see, even World War II. I mean, you could say the ending of Saving Private Ryan, maybe, but that's a brutal film. Even AI is a brutal film. I don't think the ending that some people want to, in hindsight, it is not a happy ending.
That's a really, really, really sad ending to that film.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a happy ending at all. I don't know why people thought it was. I mean, you could make the traditional case, and we even see it with the end of Lincoln. He doesn't know when to leave well enough alone. That's certainly a case that can be made for AI. But he has gone to, as Jamie pointed out, very well, that he has gone to dark places. And even if he directs one episode, I think Spielberg would hold off on that, because there's nowhere you can go with Napoleon that's going to be small. I just don't see it.
Well,
yeah, I mean, the only thing that it can be, maybe the romance, or maybe the sort of the loss of innocence and child, and when Napoleon is a child, some of those things that. The Able Dance, you know, highlighted.
Oh yeah,
the
eagle and the snowball fights and everything. Yeah,
but
and the military.
If it's going to be a birth to death thing, let's face it, it's not going to have a happy ending. You know.
Right. I mean, well, no,
wasn't
of course
a
not.
Happy ending. So I don't see that coming into play. I don't see the sentimentality or whatever coming into play in this thing, because again, you know, they're working off the screenplay, so. Spielberg is the right person to do it. I don't believe that he's going to inject a lot of his own qualities into the film. You know, other than
so here's a question for you: Who was he wanting to cast as Napoleon? Kubrick.
Oh, I don't know.
Well, didn't he talk to Nicholson about it?
Yeah. And Nicholson always held out hope, like long after even after The Shining. He said, you know, I know I'm too old for it, but I still want to do Napoleon. Yeah, and he always dreamt of doing that with Kubrick.
Well, what, do they get Danny DeVito to play it now? I mean, what the...
Well, I, you know...
In the one, they're going to go to Russell Crowe.
Yeah.
That's an interesting choice. I could see that.
Well, the script is available for everyone to read. It is part of that Napoleon book set that you mentioned, Dean, and it's online. So let's see how much it'll be reworked. As Kubrick even stated, he wanted to rework it from his draft that's out there and available now. So.
Right.
Okay, let's get to our first guest tonight, Thomas Jane. You know him from films like The Thin Red Line.
Dander, The Mist.
Well, the Mist.
You can count on me. Boogie Nights.
Boogie Nights.
Boogie Nights.
Great character actors in Boogie Nights. Let's not forget the short-lived Hung.
Yeah, the only thing short about that show. Anyway, the upcoming Gasparilla Film Festival, it takes place in Tampa, Florida. It takes place the 19th through the 24th. Thomas Jane will be receiving the Career Achievement Award there, and also... they'll be doing a special anniversary screening of The Punisher. The Punisher was released in 2004, but it was shot in the Tampa Bay area in 2003, so this makes it kind of a 10th-year reunion between Thomas Jane and the Tampa area. So it'll be an exciting event. You can read more about it at GasparillaFilmFestival.com. Here is Mr. Jane telling us all about The Punisher, what his hopes were for the film and the series that never actually happened, and some other things about the great craft of acting that he's dedicated his life to.
Well, I'm really looking forward to the Gasparilla Film Festival, because that's actually in my neck of the woods, so I'll be able to go up and meet with you.
Oh, great. What is that, Tampa?
It is Tampa, yes, sir.
Okay, good. Well, that's where we filmed the Punisher movie, okay.
What was that experience like shooting in Tampa?
We tried to make it look as dark and dirty as possible, which was not easy in sunny Florida. It's a beautiful part of the world, and what I enjoyed the most about it was the thunderstorms that we got.
Yeah, it's pretty schizophrenic weather here.
Yeah, so I was digging the dark clouds and thunderstorms, you know. We definitely tried to... you know, get some of that on film, because it was really pretty. And, that's what I remember the most, is sitting outside my beautiful penthouse apartment on the bay and looking out at these incredible cumulus thunderstorm clouds as they'd roll in, and it would storm for about 20 minutes, and then it would quit. I guess it at the time I thought that it matched my character's inner... persona in her life.
well, this character in The Punisher, it was something that you were very passionate about, wasn't it?
Yes, to tell you the truth, I've been collecting comics all my life, but I hadn't read any of the Punisher comics until they offered me, you know, the part. Initially, I turned it down because I just wasn't into superhero stuff. You know, then the Marvel guys pointed out that Frank Castle was the only sort of non-superhero in the whole Marvel universe.
It really is the humanity of Frank Castle that definitely appeals to me, and I know probably all other fans of the movie and the comic series. That movie was came out prior to The Dark Knight, I believe. So audiences weren't necessarily used to a very kind of human, flawed comic book film.
That was really upsetting for me, is that I spent the whole time I was working on that movie through that movie, and then the work that I put into the sequel that I aborted. My whole mantra was the flawed anti-hero, the dark world. Basically everything that The Dark Knight turned out to be, I was pitching and fighting for Frank Castle. And then, of course, The Dark Knight went on to make $500 million around the world. So that was, you know, kind of bittersweet for me. It was vindicating, and it was also, you know, frustrating.
Yeah.
Because those are the, you know, that's what I know that there's an audience for that kind of character, because that's kind of stuff that I personally love. You know, I've always loved the movie Rolling Thunder and you know, Taxi Driver, and you know, and I'm a fan of the Dark Knight series and Death Wish, and you know, all that stuff, and I do think that now more than ever there's a good need for that kind of catharsis in our society.
I think so too. I was thinking about that today when I was reflecting on the movie. I mean, it's a very kind of, in terms of the themes that character in that film explores, it's very primal. I mean, he's almost
right,
like the avenging angel, and I think that does fit in with our frustration now. I think we need a character like that.
Yeah, and you know, and further than the avenging angel, I think what you've got is really a lot of what John Ford and John Wayne did with The Searchers, is that you've got a character who society needs a guy to guard the gates, and as a guardian of the gates of hearth and home and family and love, you yourself are excluded from those things that you're guarding, you know, and I think that everybody can relate to that in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, you know, everybody, you know, the truth is that real love is willing to get your hands dirty for things that you love and and make sacrifices so that the people that you respect don't have to, you know. So
yeah.
This is someone who basically breaks the law and becomes a criminal so that you don't have to. And I love that sacrifice. I love that outsider badge that people, you know, can sort of decide to wear themselves. You know, nobody anoints them as guardian. It's a self prescribed position. It's a mantle that you decide to take up based on your own experience, and that's sort of the definition of a vigilante, right? You know, you've decided to fight for what you know to be right, and at the expense of being able to enjoy those rights yourself. the shit's deep, and that's why I think it's such a rewarding and character. And to just kind of label him as an angry guy who kills people because they killed his family is really selling the whole concept short.
Well, you made a short film a little while ago that is just incredible. It's phenomenal, your short film. It's the Punisher Dirty Laundry, and that was an amazing short. But do you have hopes that you can return to Frank Castle in a feature film form?
I actually did the short because my short was kind of a way of sort of saying goodbye to that character in a way that, you know, and sort of leaving a taste of what of the world that lives, you know, the Frank Castle that sort of lives inside of me. I just wanted to get a little taste of that out as a homage to a character that I love and a sort of a genre that I. A take on a genre that I'm partial to. You know, I'm very partial to the work of the 60s pulp crime novelists, the Donald Starks and the Harry Whittingtons. The Parker character, and then all of the great stuff that was put out in sort of the late 50s all through and really kind of continues to this day in the Hard Case Crime series. And I thought that the Frank Castle character, having been born out of that world in the pulp novel, crime novel called The Executioner, that's really where I see the roots of that kind of character, which is right in line with Death Wish.
Yeah.
And the Point Blank with Lee Marvin, that kind of stuff. I see a wide open door that can really be mine. People love that kind of stuff if it's done right. So whether we do it with the Frank Castle character or maybe some other character, you know, I
completely agree with you. I mean, I'm hungry for those types of characters again that were especially prominent in 70s cinema that I adore.
Sure.
But this is what I'm curious about, because you founded your own comic studio, Raw Studios.
Mm-hmm.
All of these character traits and all of these influences that you're talking about, do you find that those are at play when you're putting together your comic books?
Yeah, we intend to explore that kind of territory. We started out just for fun, some science fiction comics and some stuff that I had written. And we were very successful with the Bad Planet series. And we'd recently came out with the adaptation of my movie Dark Country, which was also very successful, illustrated by Thomas Ott, who's one of my favorite illustrators. And you know, where I'd love to explore some of that, you know, territory that we've been talking about within my own imprint, I working on some stuff like that right now. I guess I am sort of branching out with the Dirty Laundry, which I produced, and I guess we're taking matters into our own hands, and I'm directing my first theatrical feature this summer. It's a Western.
Wow.
That we're putting together called A Magnificent Death from a Shattered Hand, and we're very excited to have invited Nick Nolte to join us and some other terrific actors.
I saw the cast that you're assembling, and I'm really excited about this project. First of all, because
because Westerns are so rare nowadays, and they're the great American cinematic tradition. So I always welcome a new Western, and your cast is just phenomenal, and I'm so pleased that you're getting behind the camera again.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, that's really, you know, the way it's got to be. I mean, I have a very specific vision about, and I always have, and I'm probably been a pain in the ass to work with as an actor because I'm constantly asking the director and the cinematographer, questions that I shouldn't be as an actor, but it's hard for me. I bring them reference material and I bring them photographs and books and costume pieces and try to influence the world, because the world that I see, and to tell you the truth, I like the world that I've created for these movies better than the movies themselves that have come out. So it's just a occupational hazard, like they say. Mm-hmm. everybody wants to direct, but it's really been in my blood since the beginning, and I feel like all the acting that I've done over the years has really been training for getting behind the camera. So I'm really excited to be doing that. I've always been good with story and scripts, and I've contributed to greatly to the script that we're doing, and actors are really responding to it. I'm very excited about sort of a new phase in my career where I'll probably have to be an actor for hire in the foreseeable future, I foresee a place where I would just be producing and directing my own stuff. And frankly, I'm more excited about that than I am about getting in front of the camera.
Well, tell me why that is. Is it the fact that just directing feels all around more creative, or?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You're the storyteller, And although I love acting and I love actors, great deep respect for them and what they do, I've just never been happy in just interpreting the script and then leaving it and going home and going on to the next job, where the producer and the director and the editor go and get to have the real fun of creating the piece of art, the piece of the world that everybody gets to see. I mean, for me, that's always been the reason to do what we do. I've always loved it. A lot of actors, don't get involved with that. They've got no desire to do it, and that's fine. But I've never been that way. I've always been more excited about what the process, I think, than most of my peers, and when we made The Mist with Frank Darabont, I literally sat in the editing room with Frank and watched him put the movie together for about 8 weeks, and for me that was like an incredibly instrumental experience. I learned a hell of a lot from Frankie.
Well, you've worked with the greatest directors there are. I mean, from P.T. Anderson to Darabont to Malick to, I mean, they're all over the place.
I worked with a lot of good ones. That's true.
Absolutely. Before I let you go, because I know that you have other interviews coming up, but you're receiving a Career Achievement Award at the Gasparilla Film Fest. How does that make you feel to receive a Career Achievement Award?
I feel like I'm just getting started, so...
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure, I feel like it's very nice. I'm honored to be honored at the film festival. But mostly I just look to the future and what's ahead. I have a lot of stuff left to do. So I just, this is good. It spurs me on to get busier and stay busy.
Yeah. Well, when you look at the back at the beginning of your career, when you first decided, I'm going to give acting a shot, and I know you did theater and then you got into film, and then you look at where you are now. I mean, is it different than you expected it to be, or is it exceed what your expectations were?
Well, my expectations were to just make acting a career. I just wanted to make a living at it. And I wanted to excel at the craft, you know. And now it's up and down. I mean, sometimes I feel like I've made a contribution. And other times, you know, I feel like I have not. And I got a lot, you know, I still have a ways to go. But my goal has always been to give something back to the art that's inspired me so much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think for a lot of people, whether it's more than just entertainment, you know, I think that it can change lives and it could change attitudes and storytelling can influence as culture. I just want to create as much. I just want to give back, you know.
Okay, that was Thomas Jane. Go to GasparillaFilmFestival.com to read more about his appearance at the upcoming festival that takes place the 19th through the 24th in Tampa.
Oh, that's great.
So are you going to that film festival?
You're on the jury.
Yeah, I'm on the grand
jury. You're on the jury. I've got the Atlanta Film Festival coming up this weekend, this coming weekend, so I guess next week I'll be reporting on it a little bit. The opening night movie is Mud.
That should be really good.
Jeff
All right.
Movie. So we should hear about that next week.
All right, that's great. Well, before we go any further, I just want to put out a public service announcement. Even though this is happening tonight, when people listen to it, though, they can go back and watch it. Tonight at 9:00, you can watch the first episode of The Broken Continent at thebrokencontinent.com. And if you go there, I've seen the whole thing. It's wonderful. I saw it Thursday night. It's going to be divided into three parts, so it'll be showing for the next three Sundays at 9:00, and they're cut like I think 6 to 7 minutes each. And you can go watch it at thebrokencontinent.com starting tonight at 9:00. And we had the creators of this on, I think, was it July or August, Jamie, of last year?
Yeah, it was over the summer. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. And it's wonderful. It's really one of the most successful Kickstarter campaigns. And please watch it, and please tell your friends to watch it, so they can keep doing this series, because they. Instead of starting another Kickstarter campaign to make further episodes, they'd really like to see this thing picked up, whether it's online or by the Sci-Fi Channel or FX. They're going to start taking this to festivals and everything. So please give it a shot. It's really worth your time. That's at thebrokencontinent.com, starting tonight at 9:00.
And each episode is 6 to 7 minutes?
Yeah, about 6 to 7 minutes, yeah.
So when they screened it, what did they screen, like the first three episodes? Or
They screened the whole thing, actually.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So this is good. And it does the most important thing that a TV series can do, an episode can do, makes you want to see more. So when you're done with these, you're like, you really want to see where they're going to take this.
Well, it's ambitious as hell.
It is.
The costuming
really
and the fight sequences, and it's kind of... I mean, it's kind of geared towards the Game of Thrones crowd in a way, because that's the cat's meow nowadays.
And yeah.
So, yeah, that's a smart move.
If you like Game of Thrones, you'll definitely like this. And Jamie said it's very ambitious, and it really shows on screen. So please give it a shot.
Good, good. Hey, South by Southwest is going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
So the early reviews of the Evil Dead remake have come out. Which is the one thing that I love about that. First of all, I think the trailers and the marketing look creepy as hell.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I really do. But secondly, I love the movie poster. All the advertisement that says the most horrifying film you will ever experience. I love that. I love that they did that.
Right.
Reviews have been pretty good. I mean, overall, I've read a couple that have said that it's definitely creepy. It plays a little bit with the structure of Sam Raimi's version, and yet it maintains a lot of the odes to Sam Raimi's filmmaking.
Okay.
Bruce Campbell was there, and he talked. He did a Q&A after they screened it, and the audience loved him. I mean, he's like this cult icon.
He is, yeah.
The other big thing about South by Southwest that caught my attention, they're premiering a documentary on John Milius.
Oh, I can't wait to see that. I really can't wait to see that. And I hope maybe we can get him on, because he'd be a fascinating interview.
Well,
yeah.
you can sit out on that, because I'm scared of him.
Oh, he's not. No, I mean, I have friends who are friends with him, and they worked with him for a little while for a TV show that I don't think ever materialized. This was in the early 2000s, but it was a show, I think, that was going to be on, like, the exploits of the Coast Guard and everything. I mean, he is kind of scary, but he's very nice, though.
Yeah. Well, and there's a really great conversation. Francis Ford Coppola interviews Milius. It's for about a half an hour, and that's on YouTube. I watched that the other week, and it was really interesting. They talk about Apocalypse Now, of course. But all the biggies, I mean, Coppola's in the documentary, and Spielberg, and Lucas, and Scorsese, all the biggies are there.
And about a mile out, we'll put on the music.
Music?
Yeah, I use Wagner. Scare the hell out of the slopes. My boys love it.
I'm John Milius. I'm a filmmaker, a historian, and a storyteller.
John Milius had more movies made than any writer in the history of Hollywood.
He was really one of the first guys who said, hey, this is how people talk.
Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
He doesn't write for pussies, and he doesn't write for women. He writes for men, because he's a man.
He's not one of those directors that just goes from one movie to the next.
He made the most defining films of those decades.
It's pretty staggering, the journey he took to get there.
John is such a great storyteller just in life.
Francis couldn't tell a story like John. George is a great storyteller. He couldn't tell a story like John. None of us.
He likes to blow it up bigger in life.
And then he's created this persona.
I've heard that he referred to himself as a Zen anarchist.
I hear Milius pull a gun on some executive.
I like John because he says what he thinks, although I sometimes worry that he doesn't think.
He's the teddy bear with an AK-47.
He wanted to make himself into a legend.
But Milius hasn't made a film since what? Flight of the Navigator, did he make that?
Flight of the Intruder was, I think, the
Intruder.
Last he made. I think he directed. Now, he's been attached to things, and I think he was also, he was a producer, or he had some stuff to do with Deadwood, and he did a TV movie, The Rough Riders, that he directed on Teddy Roosevelt that came out in the mid-90s. I'll look him up. I'll take a look here and see what I can find. But he's been attached to a lot of things.
He was connected with Rome. He was one of the creators
Rome,
of Rome.
That's what I was thinking of. Thank you. Rome was what. So he has been, there's a lot of stuff he's been, he's got, like I said, there's a screenplay on Genghis Khan, and he's obviously an expert. He loves Genghis Khan, from the intro. I mean, Conan the Barbarian has a lot of that in it, and also in the original Red Dawn, the teacher is giving a lecture on Genghis Khan. Rome was, that's the one. But he's been attached to so many things that never really, Rough Riders was the last thing he directed.
Mm-hmm.
So that was 97. You know, what is it, the most famous, one of the most famous things in later years about him is that the character in The Big Lebowski is based on him.
Yeah, John Goodman's character, Walter.
Oh, mm-hmm.
But I remember the other year when I was interviewing Rick Waite, the cinematographer, the guy that did Footloose and Cobra, but also did Red Dawn, and I asked him to tell me a John Milius story, and he said that they were out in the woods. It was freezing cold. It was miserable and wet and cold, and they couldn't get John Milius out of his trailer. And so the crew was waiting for like an hour or so to get the shot, and Rick Waite's getting pissed off. And finally, Milius comes out of the trailer, and Rick Waite starts to get on to him and says, we could have all gone home if you're not serious about getting the shot. And Milius said, I'm so sorry. I've got a girl in there, and she gives the best blowjob I've ever had in my life. So.
He lectured. He gave a lecture at, when Saul, my brother Saul, was at film school at USC, and he said, if you guys try to, like, pass off your script to me, I have so many guns, I'll kill you. Don't even think about coming to my place. I'll shoot you.
Yeah.
I bet he's really funny.
He is. No, he's hysterical. I mean, he's really a very funny, very smart guy. Yeah.
Okay, so they confirmed Carrie Fisher, Mark Hamill, Harrison Ford for the next Star Wars. Billy Dee Williams is lobbying to return. Billy Dee.
Wait, why can't Lando come back? Why the hell can't Lando come back?
I don't know. I they haven't approached him, apparently.
Oh, my God, that's just horrible. That's awful. Oh, my God, that's horrible.
Well, they got to do that. I mean,
yeah, they really do.
it's dumb.
I mean, if they're going to have the kid who played, the guy who played Wicket, the Ewok or whatever, he's going to come back, but Lando can't come back? What the hell is up with that? I mean.
Well, they're doing
Some people are saying, I just read an article at Entertainment Weekly where some people are saying I guess they used this as their jumping off point, you know, Joss Whedon's comment that he wouldn't actually go back and revisit the old characters. He would just press forth and do new stuff. He wasn't really commenting on the fact that, you know, the actors are now older. He was just saying that he would go and do new stuff. However, you know, now there's this kind of, you know, as there will be on the net, you know, some kind of speculation on whether, you know, whether it'll be a bad thing to actually see these characters, you know, in their old age.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, it's important. They have to be in it. You need that bridge. You definitely need that bridge. But here's the thing. Who knew that Harrison Ford wanted to come back so badly? You would have that never dawned on me. He has talked so negatively about Star Wars all this time. Who knew that he wanted to come back? I mean, that's the big. We knew Mark Hamill would want to come back. He wanted to come back for the prequels. He wanted to be.
I'll tell you what I think the deal was with Harrison Ford. I mean, George Lucas made a statement last week that he already kind of had all three of them signed before he made the Disney Lucasfilm.
Mm-hmm.
Partnership. But I don't necessarily believe that. I believe he might have talked to Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill. But, I mean, Lucas lies about a lot of stuff.
Obviously.
Lucas said he had no plans for an episode 7, 8, 9. So.
Yeah.
But I think the thing that finally enticed Harrison Ford to take part was J.J. Abrams.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, you think about it, J.J. Abrams wrote regarding Henry. J.J. Abrams developed the part in Cowboys and Aliens for Harrison Ford.
Mm-hmm.
They have an ongoing relationship.
Right.
It was that comfort zone that convinced him, okay, I'll take part. My question is, how much of these will be glorified cameos? I can see Mark Hamill being used in kind of the Obi-Wan, position,
mm-hmm.
like Guinness was used in the first one.
Right.
I think they'll actually give them real roles. I think they'll be supporting roles, not just cameos.
I mean, that's really what it has to be. I don't think if he does the same thing he did with the Star Trek movie, I think that was a very inventive thing he did with Leonard Nimoy.
With Nimoy, yeah.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. if he does it where it's just a cameo, I think it cheapens it. Here's the thing, though. No one knows anything about this. We're not going to know anything about this. And you know, J.J. Abrams is going to do his best to keep this under wraps.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you're going to do that with the way this is the granddaddy of all merchandising. And the thing, the merchandise comes out so much before the movies these days, two or three months at least. I don't know how he's going to keep this under wraps. And I don't know, like we said, Lucas has a much bigger part in this than he's let on.
Do you think Carrie Fisher will return in the Return of the Jedi bikini?
No, I don't see that happening. I just really don't see. I do see her, though, being drunk throughout the whole thing, though.
She's on the wagon.
I like Carrie Fisher, but she's about as far removed from a Princess Leia persona.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is This is going to be this
be
is
like
a curiosity.
Now we're going to put this now. Yeah.
I mean, this is a curiosity because this is something like you were, like you said, you can't trust anything Lucas says because he lied about this. He lied about saying that there would never be a 7, 8, 9, but he said long ago that it was going to be not at least 9 movies. That was what was cemented into our heads.
Right.
And then, you know, there was the whole thing, if you read Premiere in the early 90s, he said, oh, I'm not interested in making movies ever again.
Some kids, they want to grow up and be president. Some kids want to be a doctor. You know, I just wanted to be bad.
Let's just get that fucking cash and go on spring break.
They kicked me out of school. I thought that was great.
Great, motherfucker! Give me all your money back!
Yes, that was the best thing in the world.
Spring break fishes.
I'm about making money. This is the fucking American dream.
I'll always remember this trip. This is really gonna be forever.
Now let me guess. Spring breakers?
Somebody loves y'all.
Why are you here?
Come on, y'all. Why act suspicious? Get in.
Give me a chauffeur.
Yeah. You can play Beyonce.
They don't know these people, and they don't know the guy. I want to go home.
Then you're going to be back right where you started. You're going to be thinking, maybe I missed something out there.
I knew y'all was special from the moment I saw you.
You're my motherfucking soulmate.
Let's cause some trouble now.
Break, break, bitches!
Down, motherfucker, down!
This Swiss belongs to me. Y'all wanna die tonight?
I want to talk about Spring Breakers. That is the first Harvey Korine movie that I'm actually excited to see.
Well, I'm holding his book. Have you ever read his book? Harmony Korine's book?
No.
He wrote a book many, many years ago, got 15 years ago, called A Crack Up at the Race Riots. And I read this like 15 years ago. And I was like digging through my books and I found that. And I like, you know, all three films that he's directed. And I think it's great that he's like all over the place finally, because he's such a character. I really look forward to it. It's one of the few films that's coming out in the next couple of weeks that I really, really want to see.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of fascinated by the cast, the Disney girls, you know.
Mm-hmm. And who better to do that than Harmony Korine? I mean,
yeah, I like that they're just going out and saying, okay, let's just trash the rest of the what we did before. And
right.
I think that's fascinating. And plus, you know, I think James Franco looks absolutely insane in it.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I'm just interested in seeing hot girls, you know, at spring break. I think that's
right.
And it's produced by that woman. What's her name? The one that did The Master and Zero Dark Thirty. And
it's Megan Ellison, not that woman.
Yeah.
The Ellisons are. I mean, I'll put it to you like this. You know, Larry Ellison, he's a genius.
Yeah, I mean, I know who she is.
The Ellisons are probably the most important thing to happen to movies and just to America in general. The Ellisons are, like, the most important family, I think, in the history of American civilization.
Well, in terms of movies, I think she definitely has been. Well,
yeah, I mean, here's someone who really puts their money where their mouth is. I mean, she really has gone on to put money in very risky movies that there's no guarantee of any return on investment. I commend her for that.
She's got an interesting career as a producer, and then she's going to be doing Spike Jonze's new movie, Her.
Right.
And Foxcatcher too. So.
Mm-hmm.
And the David O. Russell Afghan thing.
You're right.
So this is going to be a big year for her.
And then Spring Breakers.
Yep.
Yeah.
One of these films is not like the other.
Yeah, but I mean, she did finally, I think it was Zero Dark Thirty was where she finally got some return on her money.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, what do you guys think of this? Warren Beatty was at an event. and someone overheard him in conversation saying that he's interested in doing a follow-up to Shampoo.
I'm all for it.
Yeah, that just sounds like something that's never going to happen.
But I'm all for it, though. I mean, I'm definitely. Yeah. I would love to see where that character is.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't feel the same. I don't feel the same about. I can't get that excited about that idea, really. I mean, you know, are we really going to be interested in seeing where the 70-year-old former hairdresser or whatever is going to be doing now?
Now, is he
going to
direct it?
I mean, he was talking about doing a follow-up to it, so I would imagine that
if
he hires a different guy to direct it, he'll still be the one to direct it.
I wish he'd make more movies. What was the last thing he directed? Was that... Bullworth?
That was that Town and Country, right?
Well, he wasn't director in name, but essentially he directed it, yeah.
Right.
Peter Chelsum, I think, was the
director. Peter Chelsum, yeah. I would love to see him make just one more movie. I mean...
I'm sure he wants to as well.
It's the whole thing with the Howard Hughes thing did, because I thought that was a good idea.
I don't know what's going on with Howard Hughes. The last thing I heard, one of the financiers dropped out of it. I'm sure they dropped out of it because they were incredibly frustrated with Warren Beatty. Warren Beatty's his own worst enemy in a lot of ways. He talks himself out of everything. I mean, he talks projects to death until everyone's depleted and they don't get anything done.
Right.
So, Shampoo sequel, I'm sure will never happen.
No.
But secondly, I don't know what the good idea with a Shampoo sequel would be, because when you're in your 70s, you're not as driven by sexual politics as you were as a younger person.
Right.
And in terms of L.A. lifestyle, it's so kind of disjointed, and I don't know, it's a different dynamic.
It's a whole different world, you know. I mean, it's
and I don't know how that would be explored.
It just depends how they do it. I mean, look, like you said, it's probably not going to see the light of day. I mean, I don't see it happening. I wouldn't be against it, though, if it did happen, though. I mean.
But the other problem with him is he doesn't want to see anybody. He doesn't want anybody to see him get old. Yeah. So,
I don't know where we can.
Vanity has probably kept him from movies more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he should just make one final movie with Jack Nicholson. That's what he needs to do.
Yeah. They should remake The Fortune. Do it better than that.
Yeah. What a great idea. I mean, the fortune was right there on the heels of Shampoo, and everybody was certain that The Fortune would be the hit. You know, everybody put their money on that one.
Yeah. That has to be one of the major... I've still never actually seen The Fortune, because it's virtually impossible to see. But I don't even know if it's out there on DVD or not. But I have to say, that's got to be one of the only... Warren Beatty and Jack Nicholson movies, both, that I've never seen.
Mm.
Especially right in the middle of the 70s, too. That's weird.
Yeah, I watched it when I was a kid.
Yeah,
and
I haven't seen it in a long time.
It's just a complete misfire. It's everybody trying to be funny, and they're not playing anything funny. You know, it's just one of those completely... You can feel the forcefulness behind it. You know? And apparently, Stalker Channing was completely mistreated by both of them during the shooting of the movie.
Mm.
So you've seen Man Trouble?
Oh, God, I haven't seen it. I've watched a
Man
late
Trouble.
One, late one night
oh
with
my
Alan
God.
Barkin, right?
Which one is that one?
It's the Bob Rafelson. It's Alan Barkin and Nicholson.
Oh, That's another one that's following. What was that in the 90s? That was in the 90s, right?
Like 92, I think. 92, I think, was that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. No, I haven't seen that one either. That's never, have you seen that?
Yeah. Oh, a long time ago.
Blood and Wine. I'm sure you saw Blood and Wine.
Yeah.
Yeah, Blood and Wine's great. Mm-hmm. You know, all those things that he did with Rapleson.
Except for Man Trouble.
What was the other one?
Five Easy Pieces.
Oh, okay. I was thinking that he did the, what was that thing with, where he was investigating the murder, The Pledge. I was thinking that was
Yeah, that's the Sean Penn one, yeah.
That's the Sean Penn one, yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess the last movie with him was Blood and Wine, which was really good, I thought.
Yeah. With Rafelson, there's Blood and Wine, Postman Always Rings Twice, Five Easy Pieces, King of Marvin Gardens. So I think he did four total with Rafelson, if I'm not mistaken.
And then also Head, you know, where he was
he wrote it.
Right. I'll tell you, I wanted to go to the movies the other day, and I went to a big 12-plex, and I actually walked away. It was the first time, not the first time that this has happened, but it's just that sort of depressing period of, you know, all up until March or April, it's just a desert out there.
Well, you have one really great movie open. That's Side Effects. And that's come and gone, I guess. I saw Emperor the other day. That was okay. Nothing to write home about. It was all right. But you're right. I mean, we're in that period where, you know, we have to really probably this week maybe with when Stoker makes the rounds or Spring Breakers, or you've got some big budget things that look like a lot of fun at Admission and Olympus Has Fallen. And then at the end of the month, we have what may be the most anticipated movie, I think, of the spring is A Place Beyond the Pines with Ryan Gosling and Bradley Cooper. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm not too, is that the one where he's the stunt driver, driver, only it's a motorcycle this time?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, not being a big fan of Drive, that doesn't really thrill me.
Well, I think it's probably a different kind of film than Drive in one sense, so they're two different styles at work. This is the guy who directed Blue Valentine, so I'd be curious to see.
Isn't it weird to play two stunt drivers in a row? I mean, what a weird character.
Yeah, with tattoos and involved in crime. And there's a child there, you know, there's a child that he's got to save or whatever.
But it seems like much more of an ensemble than Drive. I mean, Drive is strictly really about him and his relationship.
And I don't know about that. You have the juxtaposition
of the Bradley Cooper, the good cop, who's, you know, trying to do the right thing. You have these, like, this contrasting characters here who's trying to do the right thing against Ray Liotta, the crooked cop. And so you have...
It's just a weird thing. It's like, you want me to play another taxidermist?
exactly. Well, Colin Farrell has another bomb on his hands.
Yeah.
Poor guy.
That movie actually got good reviews. Wait, which movie?
Are we talking about Dead Man Down?
Yeah.
Is that considered a dud?
Yeah. Tanked.
Oh, that's a shame. So he's made two good movies in a row that no one went to go see.
Yeah. What was it? Was it London Boulevard? Did you check out that one?
London Boulevard was good. That was good, too. But no, that didn't even get a wide release. But you had Seven Psychopaths and Dead Man Down. I think Seven Psychopaths is the better movie. But Dead Man Down's is a good. It's much better than people are letting on. It's a good little revenge thriller with some nice turns, unexpected turns in it. But you know, it's interesting. Then the other dud is Total Recall remake. I mean, that's the other.
Yeah. Do you think that people just don't like him? That they just. I just have to, you know, say, you know, like after a while. You know, because he has been in more than his fair share of non-hits.
Right, but
and
it's non-hits
just that
are much better.
I just see him in the movie, and they just turn off. There's something about him that just audiences don't care for him.
Well, I think it's that, and I just think you're... in one sense, it's a very crowded marketplace, so you're trying to get your voice heard. If you're lucky enough to actually make it to the multiplex, then you have to really, it's so hard to get distribution as it is. It's so hard to get a movie made and then get the distribution. It's like really making a movie is one of the most difficult things I think to do ever in a life. It's, you know, you get there, and look, he's a good actor. And in Bruges, Cassandra's Dream, The New World. I mean, yes, I mentioned all films that have made very little money. London Boulevard, I like. Seven Psychopaths is a screenwriter's movie. It is one of the best movies, I think, in recent time made about writing in general. This one, Dead Man Down, a lot of people would think, okay, the guy who made the original Girl with the Dragon Tattoo movies, this is his English language debut. Like most English language debuts, it bombs, unfortunately, you know. But he's a very good actor. And yeah, he's made some unfortunate choices. Alexander, Heart's War. But he's then made something like Tigerland or Phone Booth. I mean, so he's a very, yeah. Obviously he's a very good actor. It's timing. It's, you know, I don't think people are sick of him. I don't think, you know, people, if you ask the, like, you know, people on the street, are you sick of Colin Farrell? The first thing they might say is, who the fuck is Colin Farrell? And, I mean,
I think that would be the first thing, yeah.
And, you know, people, you know, who the fuck is Colin, you know, so I don't think it's anything like that. I think it's just timing. So it's like, all right, what am I going to go see? I mean, most people don't
just,
know what they're going to go see.
You just chalk it up to just bad luck.
Bad luck. It's not even luck. I mean, like, it's just, you throw it out there. It's like you want to see what sticks. And
with the exception of Total Recall, I don't think he makes movies that are meant to be huge grossers,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I
think in terms of, like, the parts he chooses and the directions he tends to go, as an actor, I think he's actually made smart decisions.
Thank you.
But he has.
I think he keeps getting better as an actor.
Why people don't go to his movies? You know, I like him. I think he's
good.
Why
don't people go to Hal Hartley movies? I mean, you know why?
Well, I know why people don't go to those, because, you know, they're only for about 0.001%.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like, why don't people go to Noah Baumbach movies? I mean, you know, I mean, it's like they're
well,
weird.
Again, you know, I mean, I know why people don't go
yeah,
to
exactly.
those movies.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think exactly.
But this is like an action movie. It's like an action movie. It's got a great cast.
Yeah,
it's you know, oh.
It's a thriller, but, you know, people just, you know, I don't...
Well, and plus it's up against the Big Oz movie.
You have
you
two
know?
Huge movies out right now that are crowding...
I mean, Dead Man Down and London Boulevard, and maybe for the non-sophisticated, something like Seven Psychopaths, are watch-at-home movies,
mm-hmm.
you know? Especially when there's a big tentpole movie that they're up against. The masses are going to race to that event movie before they will something that would be more comfortable
yeah,
to watch at home.
Exactly. And let me ask you a question, Dean. When you went to the multiplex before you left and when you looked up, how many screens was Oz playing on?
No, it was on four.
Okay. And what, on IMAX, a 3D, a 2D, a digital probably? Like they're all,
yeah.
So you have four. And then Jack was still probably playing on two or three screens.
Well, yes.
So,
that's true.
I mean... you just answered the question. It's so crowded, and you're not Dead Man Down. If it's lucky, is going to be playing on one screen at that multiplex, and it won't be at every multiplex, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, yeah, I know.
I like him. I mean, he's one of these
yeah.
guys that still hasn't broken
you.
Through with a major movie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really think. But, you know, it just takes that one movie. But
he's a good actor. He's a really
you know,
good actor.
And he tried with Fright Night, and Fright Night didn't work either.
And he was good in that. I mean...
That was an excellent movie, too. I thought that was excellent. I mean, you know, I like him. I just... Whenever I see a movie of his come out, it tanks, you know, which is, you know, 90% of the time. I'm like, poor Colin Farrell. I just feel, because I like him. I think he's
mm-hmm.
good, you know, and I'm just trying to figure out why he can't catch a break, you know.
I was watching a rerun of Dinner for Five yesterday.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The episode with Ben Affleck and Jennifer Garner, which was interesting in itself because you could tell something was starting to bloom between
mm-hmm.
the two of them. And then Kevin Smith was at the table, and then Colin Farrell was also at the table.
Oh, this was Daredevil,
Colin,
right?
Yeah, and then Colin Farrell was talking about that he had just auditioned the week before for the first time in a long time, and he said it was petrifying and so exciting. He was auditioning for Oliver Stone for Alexander, and he says, I'm sure I'm not going to get it, but it was just so exciting to be in that room. And he said he walked up to Oliver Stone, he said, Oliver, where are the hookers and the blow? And
oh, but let's look at some of these other, I mean, there's some other great parts here. The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, Odin, Crazy Heart, The Way
yeah.
Back, even something funny like Horrible Bosses, Pride and Glory is another one. And then I guess this is the other big one. There are two others I want to mention here in the last 12 years. There is Miami Vice, which is the other big
that
movie that did not make him a star.
Yeah, but he's very interesting in that movie.
Yes, he is.
He did grow on me in that movie, as did the movie itself.
Yeah. I mean, there's another one. There's Intermission, which was good. But then the other one that he's very good in is Ask the Dust, where he plays John Fante's alter ego, Bandini. But there are other movies, like, you know, we mentioned Daredevil and the Recruit. These were bids for big stardom. SWAT was another one that went nowhere.
And it seems like every time he tries out
mm-hmm.
for the big studio movies is when he actually fails the most miserably.
Mm-hmm.
And I think him reaching out and doing, you know, I'm just going to do what I want to do and do these smaller movies that offer me some opportunity to grow.
Right.
Like the Neil Jordan movie, which was very good.
Yes, it was.
Who else would you say you're wondering? Because people used to say this about George Clooney, like, why
mm-hmm.
hasn't he become a movie star yet? I mean, he hasn't had that one movie to break him through. They said that forever until Out of Sight finally hit. Who else is in that league?
But you want to know the honest truth? You know, if you want to go on that basis, Clooney is a movie star. He is not a box office draw, though, with the exception of the Ocean's movies. He is not. That's the thing that's been how. He can't seem to get that one big box office. He can't open a movie. That is that is something that has been said about him. Even with these awesome performances, Michael Clayton, Up in the Air, The Descendants, these are not, unfortunately, big movies that people will rush to. So he's had his share.
But at the same time, I think they're bigger movies than they would have been without him.
True.
But I'm talking about just kind of like, okay, you've made it, you're accepted as a movie star. I mean,
right.
You hit it.
Well, let's think now. I mean, Colin Farrell's a good choice. What about Ed Norton?
Yeah, that's interesting. That's
great performances, but not a big, but not, you know, let's be honest, he's not a box office draw. I mean,
yeah.
Not that he has to be. He comes from a very wealthy family. Acting for him is really kind of a hobby. I mean, not that he ever has to worry about starving or anything, but he is a great actor. But he has not found the Incredible Hulk, and he's also very difficult to work with too. So we have that.
There is that sense with him of arrogance and unapproachability. Mm-hmm. And I do think that Clooney is the exact opposite.
You're right.
Well,
something
of course,
about
Sam
Clooney,
Rockwell.
But... Sam Rockwell. Now that's a good one.
Yeah.
He's a great example of somebody who should be much bigger and much more respected in many more roles than he worked pretty steadily, but. He's just somebody that deserves to
and
be seen
made
like all the
great
time.
Films, Snow Angels, Choke, Moon. I mean, just and he's been in great in ensemble pieces, but he is not a household name.
Yes, I think that's an excellent choice. Of course, I would say Greta Gerwig. You know,
yeah.
Which I'm hoping. Yeah, I'm hoping that changes this year. But
we can understand why that hasn't happened because she hasn't really. I mean, she hasn't chosen movies that are seen on a are available on a mask.
The only movie I can think of, the two I can think of, is the remake of Arthur and No Strings Attached.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, pretty much. But I'd like to see her in bigger things, you know, in bigger budgeted things, just to see how she would do. And
well,
not just comedy.
Somebody like Sam Rockwell, I mean, that was the whole changing landscape of what a leading man was, the thing that changed in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
He belongs in that class, the Hoffmans. You know, when leading men weren't, there was Robert Redford and Newman still, but Al Pacino and Hoffman and Cazal to a lesser extent, I mean, these weren't people, Hackman, these weren't matinee idol actors. I mean, the leading man changed. So I'd put Rockwell in that category. I'd put Giamatti in that category.
Yeah.
I mean, these are actors that absolutely would have been the cat's meow in the second time I've used that term, in the 70s, because the climate was right for it.
Right.
They were the leading men of the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm sitting here looking at a list of actors, just trying to figure out some possible, you know, entries into this conversation. But, you know, like I'm sitting here looking at Jake Gyllenhaal. But, you know, like Jake Gyllenhaal, is he a movie star? I don't know. Is he?
He's been in big movies. I mean, The Day After Tomorrow, Prince of Persia, what's the other one, Love and Other Drugs. I mean, he's well known, though. People know who he is, I think.
Did you guys watch At End of Watch?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was good. I like that. That was good. I mean, but is he a movie star? I don't know. He comes from movie royalty, though. I mean,
that's true. But, yeah, I mean, he's somebody that, you know.
And let's not forget Zodiac.
Oh, here's somebody that I really like. It's really more of a character actor, like Sam Rockwell, but who I would like to see in more movies, because I swear, I never see him in anything that I say, boy, he was terrible in that movie, even if I didn't like the movie. John C. Reilly.
Oh, yeah.
But wouldn't you say he is pretty popular? I mean, with films like Step Brothers and Wreck-It Ralph and...
But limited to a supporting.
Yeah, I mean, he's never going to be a leading man, but he is definitely a very... Everyone knows who... They know that face. They know who he is. I mean...
I think
I'd
the
like
populace
see him
knows
in more
the
leads.
Face.
You know.
I think the populace knows the face.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And not necessarily the name. You know, there's...
Right.
Apparently, there's a great documentary that I haven't seen yet. It's playing on Showtime in the Movie Channel this month. It's called That Guy That Was in That Thing, and it follows a bunch of character actors, you know, the faces that you know from a thousand movies,
right.
you don't know their names. You know, and there's a whole thing, there's always that ongoing debate, what's the difference between a leading man and a character actor?
Yeah.
And that stumps a lot of people. They're like, I mean, what necessarily does that mean? Because Tom Cruise still plays characters, but are you saying that it's kind of like the persona wins out over everything? I mean, that's the predominant feature, is just the persona of the actor themselves?
Or the look of the actor, you know, like, I think that's kind of one of the things. You know, character actors are usually older, craggier looking, or sort of, you know, sort of off kilter in some way, like Sam Rockwell in a way.
Right.
They don't have the body body types that conform to what a movie star is. So they can be like John Goodman or Charles Durning.
Right.
You know, and be a little heavy on the heavy side. Or, you know, so, I mean, it's really a look thing. It's really sort of like a thing of, like, it's really down to looks, I think.
Well, and Redford is another interesting case because, I mean, he has a new movie coming out that he directs and stars in.
Mm-hmm.
And I've said this before about Robert Redford, undoubtedly a movie star. I think
right.
he is probably the poster child for movie star.
Yeah. At least in the last half of the century.
and I think because, mostly because he's a persona and a presence that you're automatically comfortable with. You know
right.
what you're getting. And the one thing about Redford's performances, they offer zero surprise. I think he's very good at what he does, but what he does is all he does. He's not a very inventive actor for me. There's no delineation between any of his characters, really, for me.
That's kind of true. I mean, he kind of, well, first of all, he never alters his voice or his look
mm-hmm.
very much. So that's one thing that you can say right there.
His delivery
also,
is always the same, but the, you know. But then you look at his counterpart. Then you look at Paul Newman, and Paul Newman came from the same curse. He was
right.
good looking, blah blah blah, kind of an idol's looks. But then he started to mix things up when he did The Hustler in HUD, when he played anti-heroes,
right.
where he played incredibly flawed people that were bastards. And I think he kind of fell into the latter part of his career, especially. He was only playing the old irascible coots, you know? He was like,
right.
if you want this really mean-spirited older guy, get me. But within these performances, there's so much, like, diversity and little pearls that he finds, like in Nobody's Fool or
right.
like Blaze. So I think that he was definitely the actor of the two of them.
Yeah, I mean,
definitely.
You know, he's definitely somebody that, you know, would change up. And even though he didn't necessarily alter his voice, although sometimes he would put on a certain accent or something. I was just watching him the other night, and somebody up there likes me where he plays
mm-hmm.
Rocky Graziano, and so he's got a thick accent in that, you know, or you know, in HUD, you know, with a Texas accent, or even, but there's a certain stylization to some of his roles later on, like, you know, Hudsucker Proxy, or
yeah.
you know, or Mr. and Mrs. Bridge, or
mm-hmm.
Even The Verdict, or
That's just it. You can point to Paul Newman's career, and you can point to great performances.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that you can definitely point to Redford's career and find great films that he was good in. But I don't know if any of his great films it scream great performance necessarily.
Even when you go back and you take a look at something like what he got his only Oscar nomination for as an actor, which was for The Sting,
mm-hmm.
When you look at The Sting, it's like, okay, why did he get an Oscar nomination for this? I mean, it's not entirely clear, except, you know, to say that, you know, he was the biggest movie star at the time. So,
mm-hmm.
But then you have somebody like Gene Hackman. Gene Hackman has a set of mannerisms that are totally his own that you can see in every movie he does. And yet it's not so much that he is a chameleon. It's just that he's such a great actor that all of these characters so believably filter through who he is. He's not trying to be someone else necessarily, I don't think.
Right.
Do you understand the dynamic I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What can you bring to the part? What there's something about Hackman that is automatically authentic.
Yeah.
Where any character he tries on is believable.
Right.
Yeah, it's a weird talent. But it's so true because he doesn't change that much in movies either. You're right.
He doesn't have to put on a limp or disguise. I mean, he's done that in the past. I mean, something like Heartbreakers, he's just really funny in Heartbreakers, and he looks a bit different. But
he's Gene Hackman, but yeah.
Right.
I was just watching. Interestingly, I watched two Michael. It's a Michael Ritchie movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
his first two movies. I watched. Interesting, we're having this conversation because I watched this past week. I watched Downhill Racer.
Oh yeah,
1959 with Robert Redford actually playing somebody who's not incredibly likable in that film. That's one thing that's a little different from that movie and his performance in that movie is that he's kind of an asshole. And Redford was unafraid of playing, distasteful roles or distasteful characters early on in his career with things like, Big Foss of Big Halsey and Little Foss or whatever. Little Foss and Big Halsey or whatever that is, that movie is, where he's the motorcycle rider. Redford is in Downhill Racer with Gene Hackman.
Yeah.
Gene Hackman plays his coach, and he's a skier, a championship skier, Redford. And that's a really, really underrated
mm-hmm.
movie. And definitely one I would put into the Redford sort of playing a character role. Probably his most different kind of thing that he ever did.
Well,
the next night I said, well, I'm going to look up Prime Cut and take a look at that. And of course, that's Gene Hackman too, in a supporting role, playing Marianne. Have you guys
that's
seen
that? That's a crazy role. I mean, that's crazy. What about something like Scarecrows?
I mean, Gene Hackman is incredible. I'll tell you an actor that wants to be like Gene Hackman, but is actually like Robert Redford, and that's Kevin Costner.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Costner wants to be that everyman, but wants to be like the true chameleon actor. But he's not. I think he is as kind of likable a presence in a lot of ways as Redford, and just as boring and predictable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, he is. I mean, I think he does. He definitely falls in that Robert Redford category of just just being this sort of steady presence in films, but never really going out on a branch to try something incredibly risky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I wanted to mention a couple of other actors that I always wondered why they weren't bigger. John Cusack is one of them.
I think that window's closed now. He put in a lot of iconic performances. I won't lie to you. And he was big. I mean, he talked to anyone from like my generation, and that's like their go-to actor. Girls loved him. I mean, there's a certain like Generation X and Generation Y love John Cusack. So he is big, but he's now much more, I think, on the political front than anything else. He's really has a lot. I mean, Huffington Post, he writes for them, but I think he's much more interested in that right now than he is in movies.
Okay, and then here's another one, Ewan McGregor. Is he really?
Wait a second. This is very interesting. I mean, while beginners may not be a actually, if you guys want to find out who, I mean, someone like Ewan McGregor is definitely very popular, but like beginners and salmon fishing in Yemen, but he's also in Jack the Giant Killer. This is a guy who actually survived the Star Wars curse. He actually is very popular. But if you want to get a good idea of who's popular, especially among younger people, just go to Tumblr and type in a name. Type in Ewan McGregor. Type in James Franco. Type in all these guys, actually. They're popular. They have a following. They have a huge following, actually. Ewan McGregor is incredibly popular. I mean, is he like a name brand? Is he someone, I can't wait to see the next Ewan McGregor film, but he has a huge following. Cusack's another one that will always have a huge, if not cult, following. That's not going to go away. I think Ewan McGregor, there's still a lot of things. I mean, the Ghost writer. Let's not forget that. I think that's one of his best performances ever. Now it's a little seen movie.
I think there are tons of great actors out there.
Yeah.
What I think is that movie stars as we once knew them are dead.
That era is over.
Exactly. The era of the movie star is largely dead. There are, in terms of movie stars guaranteeing an opening, an automatic interest in their movies, I think that died in the 90s. And I think the last actor that was really a movie star who did that was Will Smith. And now it's not even Will Smith. I mean, that has just changed.
Right.
Uh-huh.
That's a good point. I mean, that's a great point. I mean, we have witnessed that. I mean, Jim Carrey can't open a movie. Harrison Ford can't open a movie. Tom Cruise, I mean, was almost like a Mission Impossible film that he can open, but it has to be a huge franchise, though. I mean,
I'm surprised I guess Cruise is kind of on the downward slide a little bit.
They always say that about Tom Cruise, though, and definitely there was evidence to say that before Mission Impossible 4, but then Mission Impossible 4 became his highest-grossing movie ever.
Yeah.
And then they said that about Jack Reacher. Jack Reacher didn't perform as well here in the States as they had hoped, but it performed well enough overseas that now they're talking about doing a sequel to Jack Reacher. Oblivion,
okay.
I mean, who knows? Oblivion's a highly expensive, risky movie. It's opening in April.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I want to say this about Tom Cruise, though. Remember, because Mission Impossible 4 did so well, that whole everyone said he saved Hollywood. I mean, there was that whole thing. Tom Cruise is the one actor who really saved Hollywood. So after that did so well, people were really...
It changes. I mean, I've learned never to count Tom Cruise out because in spite of all the scandal he's a part of.
Yeah.
I mean, he just has to release the right movie, and there you go. He's on top again.
Yeah.
And we like...
I'm just sort of surprised, too, that, you know, some of these actors that I'm mentioning, I would also mention Mark Ruffalo as my last one in there.
Right.
But what I'm really saying, I guess, is that I was expecting, like, for instance, with Ewan McGregor, he's had a terrific career, and he's very good in most of the things he's in.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm kind of surprised that there hasn't been that one role that came down the thing that was just going to down the pike that he's just going to live forever in people's minds. Like, you know, like I'm not talking about Obi-Wan.
No, but I mean, it doesn't matter.
About
it, doesn't matter. That's what he is in that sense. I mean, he's actually one of the few things you can say is actually good about that. You know, you could say, oh, my God, he's actually good in the part. Because of that, you can't get more high profile than that series.
Yeah, but when you say the name Obi-Wan Kenobi, you think of Alec Guinness. You don't think of Ewan McGregor.
For little kids, anyone 25 and under, though, they're saying, oh, you know, Ewan McGregor, that's who, because there's, you know, while we might not think much of those, the younger generations do like those films a lot. So those are the first ones they saw.
Well, I'm talking about something like, you know, playing in, this is just an example, like, but playing, you know, a president or a king or something like that, or something that's going to get him an Oscar nomination.
He hasn't had the opportunity to make a role iconic yet. Yeah.
No.
I mean,
how many roles are out there that are like that? I mean, very few and far between. Who was the last actor that made a role iconic?
Daniel Day-Lewis.
Daniel Day-Lewis just did it.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, but Lincoln is the one that's iconic. I mean...
Yeah, but his performance is iconic. It is.
Yeah, he gives a great performance. Yeah.
I mean...
It may still very well happen. I mean, but, you know, you're talking... It's just timing and everything. He has given many great performances, though. And he's got the Trainspotting sequel that he's on board for, finally. So, we'll see.
Yeah.
You're talking about Ewan McGregor.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not. Yeah, Daniel Day-Lewis. Let them make fun. Is it going to make Prick Up Your Ear? What is that? Prick Up My Beautiful Laundrette sequel? I mean, what?
Well, I think Mark Ruffalo is going to have a pretty good year this year. So, yeah.
All right.
I think he's, yeah.
As evidenced by what? What's he doing?
He's in that movie with I know that he's going to be doing The Normal Heart, and then he's going to be doing is that Foxcatcher, the movie about DuPont? Is that the Bennett Miller movie about the DuPont killing?
I think so.
Steve Carell. Carell is
right.
So he's in that. So I think that's going to be a co-lead kind of thing.
I think the last actor. This is what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about a Lincoln. I mean, that character is iconic. So it didn't need Daniel Day-Lewis to become iconic. What I'm talking about is something like Hannibal Lecter.
Right.
That kind of role, original role, that an actor makes iconic.
Okay. Yeah,
resuscitated Anthony Hopkins' career. He's still writing on that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he is. That's a tough question. I'd have to do a little bit of research into that to actually figure that out.
Use Daniel Day-Lewis for either There Will Be Blood or Gangs in New York. I mean, the same stature as Hannibal Lecter, though. I mean, that's just.
Yeah, but Daniel Plainview is a character, you know, that I would put into that category for sure.
But I don't think it's as cultural. It's not as culturally defining. It's not iconic.
No, you're right. You're right.
It's
about
not
that.
Iconic
well,
by Hannibal Lecter
yeah.
or Tony Montana.
Well, right there,
no.
You know, Al Pacino created two of the most iconic characters of all time, Tony Montana and Michael Corleone.
Absolutely. We haven't had that character that creates, like, this massive seismic shift in culture, you know?
This is true. I think that you're right about
Would you put Bruce Willis's John McClane in that?
I think that's, like, a lesser version of the two examples I gave, but yeah.
Yeah,
sure.
I mean, because I was watching Die Hard with a Vengeance last night, was on TV, and we watched that, so that's why. I mean, that wasn't really basic. I think, though, they cheapened it in the last two films, but yeah, something along. Yeah, I see. Yeah, definitely iconic, but I don't.
The last iconic, here you go. The Dude.
Yeah.
Iconic.
Yeah.
And what, yeah, that,
yeah.
You're absolutely right. That is the truly
that's,
last.
That's a good one.
And it probably would not have been if Jeff Bridges hadn't played him.
That's, you're absolutely
yeah.
right.
Yeah. Interesting question. Interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
But you can't set out to write an iconic role, I don't think.
There's no way. I don't know how you, it's all timing.
So what a trap that might be.
Yeah.
It seems like you would just sit down and your mind would go blank, you know.
I'm going to write something
iconic.
You
can say Heath Ledger is the Joker. You know,
absolutely right.
That is,
yeah.
Of all those films, that's the one, yeah.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah. So once in a blue moon, those roles come along, and those are the ones that I see as career-defining.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning you can go on from there, but not necessarily transcend. High points.
You mean, like, well, let me ask you this before we go. Christoph Waltz, who's one, basically, you know, a supporting actor,
right.
You know,
right.
For two characters that come from Tarantino, and that might be as good as it gets, you know, career-defining for him.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure he agrees with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure he knows that this is as good as it gets in mm-hmm. terms of accolades and being a part of something, you know. Because he's going to be a hard move. He's going to be a difficult actor to write leading parts for, I think. I think he's going to have a hard time minus Tarantino.
Yeah.
I don't think
people know what to do. That's the problem. I mean, like the Green Hornet or Carnage or Water for Elephants. He's playing a variation on the same, that nastiness, but not quite the, you know, not quite the same frequency.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Well, what should we close off the show with? Fuck, I don't know.
What do you got?
Yeah, what do you got?
What are you rebelling against? What do you got?
All right. Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Marlon. Okay, this is a score from Antonio Pinto. I just like the sound of that. This is a piece of film score from Snitch.
Mmm, Snitch. Not to be confused with Snatch.
Yeah, what a double feature that
right,
might be.
That's another great double feature. Snitch back.
Well, yeah, you could watch Snitch, and then you can watch Guy Ritchie Snatch, and then you can watch the Blake Edwards Switch, like back to back.
That's the triple feature to have, folks. That's your next triple feature right there.
Snitch, Snatch, Switch. That's
wow.
Great. That's great. All right, then I'll close with that.
Okay,
all right, guys.
Awesome.
So Wednesday night, we have Academy Award-winning actress Marsha Gay Harden on the show talking about If I Were You, her new film. And I saw this movie. It's really, really great. And she's stunning in it. So tune in for that. But that's an interview-only show. So the three of us don't have to sit in for it. But we will be back next Sunday.
For St. Paddy's Day.
Oh, is that what it is?
Or yeah.
St. Paddy's Day.
We can all be drunk on the air.
Oh,
well, why should anything be different?
That'll be interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll be reporting from the Atlanta Film Festival next week.
Okay,
yes.
Cool.
You can
yeah,
tell us some of the great movies that you're seeing. Awesome.
Yeah.
All right, guys. I'll talk to you next week.
All right. Cool, man.
Okay,
good night, everyone.
Good.
Bye.